You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and today it's my great pleasure to welcome back our special correspondent, Karen Button. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've just gotten back from Syria, and I'm really pleased to be able to bring to our listeners again an update from you, having just freshly arrived. It's so essential that we hear these the voices that you are going to share with us, as well as general information about how things are going with the Iraqis in Syria. So I'm going to open up and ask,
okay,
what should we know?
Well, I think the biggest thing that people should know about Iraqis that have fled Iraq, whether they be in Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, or elsewhere, is the fact that they're really getting no attention. I mean, it's the largest refugee population in the world. It's the largest movement still of any peoples in the Middle East ever. And yet there seems to be a media blackout about it. And in fact, one of the things that I think is very important for people to know as well is that the Iraqi government has been visiting Jordan and Syria specifically and asking them for lists of particular Iraqis. There are lists that they have now. For example, one of the groups that's on that list is the Association of Muslim Scholars. This is an organization of Muslim scholars. They are predominantly Sunni, but these are people who are very non-sectarian. And they do a lot of work as far as humanitarian, and they also do political work. This group has been opposed to the U.S.-led occupation in Iraq, and as such, they've been targeted both by American forces, and now they've been targeted by the Iraqi government, the U.S.-backed Iraqi government. There is a price on the head of both Harith al-Dari, who is the leader, and his son Muthanna al-Dari, who is the spokesperson for the organization. Now, that's just one example. The Syrian government has refused to turn over, at this point, any Iraqis to the Iraqi government. And they, as some of your listeners may remember, last year, the Iraqi government was successful in pressuring Syria to close their borders. They closed them for 3 days, and then Syria opened them back up. What's taking place now is some restrictions on visas. At that point, the Syrians said, okay, an Iraqi needs to have a visa before they can enter, and they need to show up at the border with a visa. So that's one point that a person has to do. What I have heard from the UNHCR is that, for the most part, even if a person does not show up with a visa, the Syrian authorities at this point are mostly letting Iraqis in. But this is what we're really seeing in Syria now is the same type of situation that took place about 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago in Jordan, which is that there started to be some restrictions. At first they were minor, and now, you know, Jordan is barely letting any Iraqis in, even if it's for medical care. I talked to a 70-year-old man who lives in Al-Dor, and he's somebody who has come out to Jordan for a number of years to get medical care. He's never tried to seek any type of living situation there, and he's being refused to be let into Jordan. And this is not an unusual case at all. So in Syria, one of the pieces that happened while I was there was, due to these new visa restrictions, people's passports are being stamped that they can stay for 3 months, but every 3 months they have to have their visa renewed. In the past, people would go to the border and they would have to actually exit Syria, enter Iraq, so that they could re-enter Syria. Now, the Iraqis...
So really just a symbolic entrance of Iraq. They didn't have to go back to Baghdad and get...
No, not at all. It was in and out. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I was at the border last year, there were a number of tour buses that were there. And these were all buses that were just packed with Iraqis who were coming out so that they could just literally go over the border and come back in.
What is the process of actually getting a visa?
The process of getting a visa is they do have to go to the Syrian embassy. It's not in the green zone. I have heard, I asked numerous Iraqis if there was any hardship with this, and they said, no, not really.
Okay.
So fortunately, that hasn't been, thus far, the biggest hardship is that they have to go through this process beforehand. Let's imagine that you've had a death threat, you know, with your family. Maybe one of your family members has been kidnapped or killed. Maybe one of them has been, arrested and killed by American forces. And you're afraid and you need to flee. And you can't flee immediately because you have to go through this process first. So some people have gone into hiding while they have to do this process. Once they are in Syria, there are, according to the Syrian government, they have to meet certain criteria. They have to be of a certain class, you know, a profession, or they have to be in Syria for educational purposes or medical purposes, this type of thing. But it doesn't seem at this point that the Syrian government is really, there's a lot of discretion at the border, let's say. And then also the Syrian government apparently at this point is not being a stickler. The education visas all expired on July 5th on July 2nd. And this was because this was the end of the school year and the exams. Mm. So many Iraqis were really concerned that, you know, after July 2nd, they were going to, you know, what were they going to be able to do if they were there on an education visa, mm-hmm. which would not be able to be restamped for another 3 months. And the Syrian government, they told the UNHCR, this is the agency that they're disseminating information through primarily, and they told the UNHCR that they wouldn't be taking any action. So for now, things look okay, but it's really tenuous. A number of the Iraqis that I met, for a period of time, the Syrian authorities were saying that Iraqis had to get their passport stamped on a weekly basis. So they didn't have to go to the border. They had to only go to an immigration office that was in their neighborhood, but they had to do this once a week. So I met a number of Iraqis who were just letting their visas expire because they were too afraid. It was so stressful for them to go back to this, you know, immigration office once a week.
And I would imagine spend several hours in line.
Of course.
Because there would be so many.
Sure, sure. But it was just the psychological stress was such that they just said, we're just going to let it expire and face the consequences. So before, most of the Iraqis that were living in Syria were there illegally. There is now an increasing number who are there illegally. And as UNHCR officials said, nobody really knows what that means in the future. Of course, in Jordan, you know, it means huge fines, and this is one of the reasons that Iraqis live so in the shadows in Jordan, because if they're picked up on the street at all and they're found to have an expired visa, they're immediately jailed, and then they're deported from the country back into Iraq.
Into Iraq. So the last time we talked, I want to remind our listeners that we have had you on before talking about the refugees, and if they go to the website, www.raisingsandradio.com, org, under the topic, the theme of refugees, they will find another interview with you. And I think that was towards the end of last year, wasn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah. So this is 6 months later, and we're now doing an update on some of that. And at that point, you had talked about the UN center that had opened up, the refugee center. Were you able to visit that center again? At that time, it was very, very crowded with people trying to get into Syria and be recognized as refugees. Were you able to visit that center again?
Yes, I did. It's called Douma, and it's on the outskirts of Damascus. And at that center is a place where they, this is where they do all of the initial processing of people's paperwork. And an Iraqi family will come there. They'll get an appointment to come back and get an interview with the UNHCR to be registered. That registration allows them to seek asylum in another country. It also allows them to get various forms of medical care and other types of assistance, especially from nonprofit organizations that are working in Syria in partnership with the UNHCR. And One thing that has happened since we last spoke is that the level of income that Iraqis have in Syria has diminished drastically. It's much, the Iraqi community as a whole is much more poor than it was 6 months ago. One of the biggest ways in which we're seeing this is that the UNHCR and the World Food Program have partnered, and they're now doing food rations for the first time. And they're also doing this in Jordan. And when I spoke with the UNHCR officials in Syria, it was the first day of the food ration after a two-month break. And this was, they had a center in the center of Damascus, which was much more convenient for people, but that center was, it was a center that the government owned, and the government basically needed it back. So the food program was cut in the middle. And it's this kind of thing. Of course, the Iraqis who were receiving the food had no idea why. And there's a huge amount of distrust with the UNHCR amongst Iraqis. And some of it, I think, is quite well-founded, to be frank. And then some of it is things like this, where they don't know why the UN stopped doing food rations. They just assume that because they've been ill-treated before, that this is another form of disrespect. However, at the Duma office, where the food rations are now being distributed, it's about 20 to 25 minutes outside Damascus. And it's quite the process. They were expecting 160,000 people to show up for this food distribution. By the end of July, they expect that there will be 200,000. And one of the things that the officials told me there is that they only have enough funding to continue this until the end of August. So they've put out a huge appeal to the international community, doubling it to 123 million for all the Iraqi refugees in the region. This is including Iraqis that are still within the country. But just to give the listeners an idea of what this means, Iraqis are given a food ration that is worth $45. This is to last for 4 months.
Whoa. And what's in there?
What's in there are things like rice, lentils, sugar, tea, the basics.
Mm-hmm. And that's each. So one family, if there's a family of four, would get four times 45, or is it?
Right.
Okay.
Right. That's right.
Uh-huh.
And then the very vulnerable families, as the UN puts it, these are women without, you know, single head of household, and then people with disabilities, the elderly. And then also those people who, you know, are unable to, you are unable, their children are going to work instead of school. Those are all considered vulnerable mm-hmm. families. So then they get a cash stipend. And the cash stipend is $100 a month for the head of household and then $10 each for each child.
Mm.
So you can imagine, I mean, it's just not that much money.
Yeah.
And a number of the families that I interviewed were actually, they were desperately waiting for this food ration because they were actually selling it to pay for their rent.
Wow.
So it's, and then the children are still not going to school then, of course, because they're going out working. And then,
and when you say children, working, this is on the streets selling gum, or what kind of work are they finding?
There's a myriad. I mean, they're on the street selling gum. They're some of them are working in restaurants as dishwashers. You know, some of them are working in grocery stores mm-hmm. as stockers. But they're making very little money uh-huh. per month. I mean, they're making something like perhaps $25 or $50 a month. You know, and they're working 12 hours a day,
yeah.
mostly 6 days a week. Those, in some ways, we could say are the lucky ones. If you will, I mean, as far as those children, because what I also encountered is there's a growing trade in children for sex trafficking, and there's also growing prostitution. I visited one of the nightclubs that specializes in Iraqi women when I was there, and it was really something. There were girls that I saw there as young as, I would say, 12 or 13. And some of the women that were working there, they had their children there even. You know, they were dancing on stage, and the children were just wandering around the nightclub. They're in a really desperate situation. And some of these, I spoke with one of the attorneys who represents some of these juveniles. I mean, if these juveniles are arrested, then they're taken to a juvenile detention center. And most of the time, they're arrested not even in these nightclubs. They're arrested in taxis, or they're arrested in villas where the act is taking place. And they are taken to this facility, and they are, most of the time, as the attorney was telling me, they are generally deported even before their trial. Now, these are people that are under 18 years of age. And when I asked the attorney, well, what happens with these girls then? And she said, well, unfortunately, she said the majority of them, they've either been sold by their family because their family is desperate, or they have been actually into prostitution. But she said the majority actually are even sold by their family into marriages. You know, 14-year-old being married off to a 60-year-old man was one of the cases that she told me about. And in this particular case, the 60-year-old man then, of course, came into Damascus, and he sold her to somebody, a pimp, basically. Wow. And then I saw a number of these pimps. Most of the pimps are women. They're older women. And these are the women who, they would sit in this particular nightclub. They sit in the nightclub. A man would go up to this pimp, this older woman, and negotiate with her for the price of the female. And this young girl then would have to go with this man, and at this particular nightclub, there's rooms in the club itself.
So you mentioned these young girls would be arrested. What about the men?
Oh, no, the men are never arrested.
The men are just let off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the men are never arrested. It's not a crime. The crime is against the woman.
So let's revisit the prostitution in Iraq in the last 15 years. There was officially no prostitution in Iraq. Prostitution was considered to be something below the honor of the society at a lot of levels. And now we have women actually running other women, Iraqi women actually running other women, other Iraqi women.
Right. Well, I think in any society, there's always going to be that element of people who are willing to benefit from other people's tragedy.
I was more thinking along the lines of, cynically, this is the freedom that we have brought to this nation of, you know, they had a social system that worked well enough. At least you didn't have a lot of prostitution. And we're actually seeing the same thing in Afghanistan. I've done interviews with women that are working in Afghanistan, and they're just appalled at the same thing you're talking about, families having to give away their daughters, young girls being actually kidnapped off the street. The freedom and democracy seems to be feeding this thing that we call the sex trade around the world.
Exactly. Well, and Iraq didn't really have, I mean, there wasn't a sex trafficking business there per se. There wasn't a mafia there. And there is a huge mafia in Iraq now, especially with this trade. One of the cases that I heard about was, let's just back up and say one of the problems in Iraq, all of the infrastructure has been destroyed. One of the casualties in this has been the orphanages. The orphanages were well established and funded by the government prior. Now the orphanages, I mean, I've talked to some people that are, you know, that head orphanages, and they say they're basically working without pay, you know, out of the goodness of their heart, or just mm-hmm. they don't want to see these kids on the street. Other orphanages, they're just desperate. They don't know, they're not being paid. They don't know how to get food for these children. And this comes down to one of the cases that I ran into. This particular case, a 12-year-old girl was living in an orphanage. A couple showed up and wanted to adopt this girl. So, of course, you can imagine the directors were happy about this, and they seemed like a fine couple, and she was adopted. Well, this couple was actually not a couple, except that they were business partners. They were a couple in that way. They brought the girl to Syria, where she was sold into a pleasure marriage, a so-called pleasure marriage. this marriage, and she was in that pleasure marriage for 6 months. At the end of the contract that they made with this man, he had to return the girl. She was returned, and then she was forced to go under an operation that repaired her hymen so that she could be sold again as a virgin. This young woman had, at the time that I spoke with the person who dealt with her, who dealt with this case, she had been sold 4 times and had this procedure done
surgery
4 times.
This is 12-year-old.
Right, who's now, you know, she's 14 now. Mm-hmm. She's 16. It was 4 years ago.
Mm. Yeah, I want to remind our listeners that we're talking with Karen Button. Karen, I'm happy to say, has been our spiritual correspondent in the Middle East, specifically in Jordan and Syria. And Karen just returned from Syria, and we're talking about some of the situation over there, and particularly now the situation with the young refugees and the orphan refugees. So, Karen, this is a depressing topic, but I think we do need to talk about it. Can you talk about this a little more?
It is depressing. I mean, it's horrific to think about how these families and just the fabric of community has been ripped apart. It's beyond belief. The thing that's really beyond belief to me, though, is how there is really very little discussion about this. I mean, we hear a lot about the crisis in Darfur. And it's an issue that deserves to have the attention. Iraq is a situation that is a much bigger crisis even than what's happening in Darfur. And we have to recognize that. We have to recognize that just because our administration is the one that's caused the majority of it, and just because our country is the country that's occupying Iraq, does not mean that we shouldn't be giving attention to the fact that there's a major crisis going on there. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really frightening is the number of people who are returning to Iraq now. We have been told time and again that the surge is working. There are pockets in Iraq where the violence has decreased some. And I've talked to Iraqis, though, that have gone back. There were a number of Iraqis. In fact, your listeners may remember I think it was September, that the Iraqi government was offering free buses and a stipend to get people back on their feet if they came back to Iraq. Well, I met families that went back so that they could get this money and then come back to Syria. Mm. I mean, that's how desperate they are just to be able to support themselves. The Iraqi government just gave $8 million to Jordan recently. And the interesting thing, I also was in Jordan, and the interesting thing in Jordan that I noticed since I was there last is all of the improvements in the city, you know, road improvements and, you know, interchange improvements and so forth. Oh. And I was asking about that, and the cynical answer that I received was, yeah, well, you've heard about the aid for Iraqis. Well, you know, I guess Iraqis use the streets too. Oh. So, but the Iraqi government, even if they're giving money to other countries to help support the Iraqis that are in exile now, is it really the responsibility of the Iraqi government, or is it not the responsibility of the occupying country? The occupying country, under international law, bears the responsibility for the well-being of the people in that country, and we are still an occupying force there.
One of the things we've heard about Syria is, because it's part of the evil axis, is that they are fully supporting the Iraqi civilians, refugees there. Now you're saying that the Iraqi government is giving money to Jordan. Are they also giving money to Syria?
That's still up in the air. Uh-huh. I mean, there hasn't been any public announcement that I've seen. I asked UNHCR officials if there's been any talk about this that they know of, and they say that they're hopeful. You know?
So Syria is still bearing the brunt of this, the full brunt of this 2 million people that have left Iraq and come for refuge there.
Right, 1.2 to 1.5 million is the estimate. But they have received some funding from the international community, actually. But it hasn't been enough. I mean, we can definitely say that.
Yeah.
And some of the money specifically has come in to assist in the schools, because you can imagine the, you know, the number of the increase in the classrooms there. The problem, of course, is that it's actually the Iraqi families themselves need the money as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, rents are going up. I mean, this is something that the Syrians are having to bear as well. And the Iraqis, you know, they always will say that, you know, once a Syrian landlord finds out that they're Iraqi, then they increase the rent. Mm. I think this is in part by, I mean, the Syrian government has definitely, they are much more, they're controlling the movement of people, let's say. For example, when I came into the city last year, I stayed with a family, a Syrian family, and I had to write down the address that I was staying at, and that was it. This year, there is a process that you have to go through whereby you fill out a form that has to be registered with the mayor's office. I mean, it's an official form, mm-hmm. and you know, it has to be stamped, and the landlord has to sign it where you're staying, and you have to sign it and provide your identification documents. So this is the case, and the Syrians see this as, you know, something that they need to be wary of. And so when an Iraqi comes and wants to stay with them, they're reluctant because they feel like, well, the Syrian government is watching this closely. Perhaps they're tracking where the Iraqis are actually staying. Mm. And thereby, you know, they're feeling that they may be more at risk. And so they're charging more for Iraqis. Mm. I mean, that's just one scenario.
So what about the stress on Syrians? I mean, it sounds as though the last time we talked, the Syrians were very welcoming and had made accommodated to a large extent this influx. And I'm wondering, at that point, I remember thinking, well, this probably is going to become a lot more stressful over time, and the Syrians themselves are going to become a lot more stressed. Are there any... do you have the sense that this, in fact, is becoming the case, that the Syrians just don't want to deal with this anymore? They just want it gone? Are they feeling more negative about it?
You know, I counted some negativity, but really the overall perspective that I've heard from people actually is that they're still saying that they feel sorry for the Iraqis. And they'll say things like, you know, it's a burden on our country, and we're not happy about the rising food prices. You know, everything is sort of blamed on the Iraqis, the rising oil prices. Well, it's because the Iraqis are here, and so on and so forth. But just to scratch the surface, I'll say, well, what should the Iraqis do? Do you think that they should go back to their country? And they say, well, no, how can they do that? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a country that's on fire. We welcome them here still. Mm-hmm. We're just, you know, we don't know. They're between, you know, they're between a rock and a hard spot, because they don't know, really. They see them as their Arab brothers and sisters. They really feel this strongly still. But there is this growing tension, mm-hmm. of course. One of the things I think that it was interesting that it happened when I was there is International Refugee Day took place while I was there. And Nasir Shama, who is he's a world-famous oud player, and he's Iraqi. He's lived in exile for a number of years. And he came to Syria and played a benefit concert. He's been really outspoken on behalf of Iraqi refugees, who, by the way, he's another person that you know, the Iraqi government doesn't welcome inside of Iraq now, because he's been speaking out about the Iraqi refugee situation. But he did a benefit concert, and it was the first fundraiser that had ever been held at the Opera House in Damascus. And I think and he raised $24,000. Mm. So, I mean, it's a drop in the bucket. Really. I mean, and to have, you know, but it was a symbol. And I think it was a symbol of the Syrian government, you know, as much as it was by Nasir Shama himself. Mm. And it's, you know, I think it's a symbol by the Syrian government saying, we support the Iraqis who are here, and we're doing our best.
Mm. What about, can you talk a little bit about what recent refugees to Syria perhaps are saying about the situation in Iraq itself? We've heard that the violence is going down. I think you mentioned that earlier. But what else are you hearing about Iraq, Baghdad, the way things are for people still in the country? I know that think it's 2 million displaced, internally displaced people. Are you hearing anything about that?
Right. Well, what people that are coming into Syria are saying is, you know, the violence from the perspective of the majority I heard that were coming up, they were saying that the reason that you are hearing that the violence is going down is because of the awakening councils in a number of these communities. But the awakening councils are groups that have been formed that are in different regions of Iraq, in different neighborhoods in Baghdad. And these awakening councils are, they're an amalgam of different groups. I mean, some of them are former gang members. Some of them are former so-called insurgents. You know, some of them are, as I've been told by, you know, some of the Iraqis, they believe that they're so-called Al-Qaeda members. So this, they feel that it's very tenuous. They believe that some, that there has been a joining of the Awakening Councils in part because they're getting paid. But they feel that it's very, like, people are just, they're afraid that this is, it's something like the lid is on, but the pot is still boiling. And one of the people that I interviewed said, look, you know, you're not going to hear about much of the violence because nobody's paying attention to, you know, if somebody gets kidnapped and they're killed by a militia member, I mean, does that make the news? No, the car bombs make the news. You don't even hear about the individuals who are being killed anymore. That's the point. So I asked, are people feeling secure and safe to go out on the streets? Some neighborhoods in Baghdad, yes. Some neighborhoods, no. But again, it comes down to some of the fact that, you know, you've got these walls of the city now. I mean, so you've got a city that is walled off neighborhood to neighborhood, and you've got checkpoints at these walls. So if people stay within their little enclave, then of course there's going to be less violence as well. I mean, this is a point that people made clearly. They said, yeah, I mean, if we stick in our neighborhood, fine, but we don't have the freedom to move around. Mm-hmm. We don't have the freedom to go to different areas. And that they saw this as a big problem.
Now, we'd also heard in the past that let's take Baghdad, had been mixed neighborhoods. The Sunni and the Shia lived together. And then I think it was about a year and a half ago, we started hearing that there was a push to push the Sunni out into Sunni areas and the Shia out into Shia areas, and that there was actually somewhat of a trade in moving people from house to house, switching houses. Are you hearing that that's going on? Is that settled? I'm assuming that there were a lot of houses that were vacated by the refugees fleeing from these neighborhoods. Did you hear anything about that, the squatters that are in these houses that have been vacated, has the division of the two groups, the Sunni and the Shia, completed? Or
basically, what's still happening is that people are being targeted. And if they're being targeted and they're being pushed out of their house, then it's immediately occupied by one of the militias. I mean, I still heard a lot of this. And people were not really talking sectarianism as much as, well, let me illustrate with one family story. This is a woman and a man who are a mixed marriage. She is Shia and she is Sunni and he is Shia. They were living in a neighborhood in Baghdad that was predominantly Sunni. They were asked to leave this area. They left this area, and I mean, I'm going to simplify here because, I mean, you can imagine, let's just assume that, I mean, it's not a simple leaving. This family was, I mean, they were threatened. They had drive-by shootings at the house. You know, when one of the children was injured, they finally decided they needed to leave. Okay, so that's how they left this area. They moved into one of the Shia areas. In this area, they were also targeted. And in this area, it was, again, some drive-by shootings. They were threatened. And, in fact, then one of their sons was kidnapped. He was released finally, but when they brought him back to the house, they knocked on the door after the family had paid a ransom, and they knocked on the door to bring the son back. When they opened up the door, they beheaded the son in front of the whole family. So the family, again, I mean, they were terribly traumatized. They fled from there. The husband was working as an oil truck driver. And so he was driving back and forth into to the south. The wife thought, well, maybe we can, maybe there's some way that we can go and we can and live down there. So they were able to rent a house. They fled down there. 3 days later, there was a sign that was painted on their, you know, spray painted on their house that said, Sunnis are not welcome here. Mm-hmm. So they fled once again. She was terrified. The husband and wife at this point were separated because he was driving his truck. She didn't know what to do. So she fled. She took into the desert, and she, as she described it, lived for 6 days in the desert with her children, without food or water, not knowing where to go. Mm-hmm. They were able to get word to her husband. And as he was coming to collect them, his oil truck tanker was attacked and it was blown up. He amazingly survived the explosion, but he was incredibly injured and badly burned. He was taken to a hospital. At the hospital, because this was in the South, you know, he was taken in there, and she said that they found out then, of course, that he was Sunni, and they had to immediately transfer him out of the hospital. I mean, the story just goes on and on like this. And she, you know, when she was describing this story, she broke down and she said, you know, you can't imagine what it's like to lose your son like this in front of the whole family. The whole family's been traumatized. And she said, and there's the husband has a disability as a result of this. He was laying on a thin mat in the bedroom. And she said, he can't even work now. He can't do anything to support the family. And she blamed herself. She said, this is all my fault. It's all my fault because, you know, she said, I'm sorry to say this, but it's mostly been the Shia who have attacked. And it's because I'm Shia, and I married a Sunni man. And this is, you know, this is the face of Iraq today. You know, but we've also, I mean, there's the case of the Sabians, which has had very little press. I mean, the Sabians are a community of people. They're non-Christians. They're direct descendants, they believe. They follow John the Baptist. You know, they're one of the oldest religious groups in the world, and they only exist in Iraq. And they're one of the last communities of people that actually speak Aramaic. These people have been targeted from all sides, and the majority have now fled, and they're being dispersed across the world. I mean, so here's a community of people that are indigenous only to Iraq. As some of the Iraqis that I worked with said, these are really the true Iraqis. Mm-hmm. and they have a leader. And this religious leader, I mean, how can that religious leader govern, you know, from disparate places around the world? The largest community of them are in Australia. Mm. And so the majority are hoping to go to Australia, but they're being scattered throughout the world. The U.S. government is focusing on trying to bring either people who have been translators with the U.S. military or, you know, worked with contractors, or they're focusing on bringing the Christians. You know, meanwhile, the majority of the Iraqis, you know, people like this family that I just mentioned, I mean, what hope do they have of being settled anywhere? Mm-hmm. Another family that I interviewed, this was a Sabian family, and who also has a quite horrific story. The wife was kidnapped, and she was, you know, and she was raped repeatedly. She was 5 months pregnant and lost her child. When they were able to finally flee to Syria, the son was actually kidnapped in Syria, and he was kidnapped by a Syrian gang. And
kidnapped,
you know,
for money.
He was kidnapped for money. It was, yes, this is one of the important pieces, because I asked, was it because he was Iraqi? And she said, no. They said that they wanted money. Mm. And it was
assuming that since they had left Iraq, they brought a bunch of money with them. And
it was actually the Sabians, because the Sabians have, there was discrimination against the Sabians, much like there's been discrimination against the Jews. And so they were allowed to work mostly with their hands. And this is why, you know, it's, you know, Jews became known as being goldsmiths and being bankers, because, you know, this was jobs that other people didn't want to take, handling money. And with the Sabians, they then developed handicrafts in goldsmithery. And so they're seen to, you know, have money. They're thought that they're the rich people in Iraq.
So the son was kidnapped.
So the son was kidnapped. Fortunately, he was released after a day, and there was no harm to him, except psychologically, of course. And, you know, this is, I mean, this is something that is really, I mean, I would really like people to try and understand. I mean, maybe people think, okay, once people are able to flee Iraq, they're safe, everything's okay. And, yeah, if for the most part, you know, we can say that they're safer than they are in Iraq, absolutely. But there's still, I mean, another situation. This woman actually declined the interview, but that I could do with her directly. But the friend of hers that agreed to talk with me said she was kidnapped by one of the militias, and she was raped when she was in Iraq. She escaped to Syria. She was threatened with her life, of course. Her family was amazed that she was even released. She escaped to Syria. And one day when she was in Sayyid Zainab, one of the neighboring communities inside of Damascus, she saw her attacker. Mm. And she's terrified. She's terrified to even leave her house now. Mm. And she doesn't know what to do. This is the situation that most Iraqis are facing. And, you know, that are outside of the country. And meanwhile, there's huge amounts of pressure by the Iraqi government to bring all the Iraqis back, as if there is no problem, as if Iraq is not on fire.
And do you think that's the thought behind that? As long as we get them back here, they're not going to be out in the public eye. We've got them back in Iraq, and no one will really know what's going on with them, since there's very little news coming out of Iraq.
Right. Well, look, I mean, my personal opinion about this is just my opinion. I think it's an embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
I think Iraqis outside of Iraq are an embarrassment to the Iraqi government, which is backed by the U.S. government. Therefore, it's an embarrassment to Mr. Bush.
It's an embarrassment to the failure of the surge.
It's an embarrassment all the way around, mm-hmm. you know, to the failure of occupation that drags on. Mostly so that the oil resources can be extracted, as we're seeing now with the current oil laws that are being pushed through.
Which suddenly is as if everyone always knew it all along that it was about oil, but we spent 4 years saying, no, 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 it's about freedom and democracy. And then when it hit the pages as, yes, when I'm talking about the pages, I'm talking about in the United States, it was like, well, yeah, so who didn't know that?
Exactly.
We skip over this whole thing that ought to be brought to discussion, brought to justice, brought to something. We just skip over it now. Of course it's about the oil. I guess it was Greenspan that said that.
Right.
And then it became okay to say it.
And now everybody just assumes, well, then that's fine.
Right.
You know, okay, we've acknowledged it. It's fine. Let's move on.
Or maybe it's since Americans are paying so much for gas, the money is somehow ending up back in Iraqi pockets. But I think it's important to recognize that it's really not ending up in Iraqi pockets at all. It's ending up in the pockets of Mobil, Exxon, Chevron, these corporations that have been trying for a very long time to get back into Iraq's oil resources.
Right. Well, and as an Alaskan, I was very interested to see that one of these people is the multi-billionaire Hunt. We had a downtown building in Anchorage that was named after him. Mm. It was the Joe Hunt Building. Mm. But this is the same individual, you know, that had made the first deal in Iraq with the Kurdish government.
Uh-huh.
You know, and is you know, back in Baghdad, you know, of course, buying for the other oil fields. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, it's something that's really despicable to see, especially, I mean, again, as an Alaskan, we just saw, you know, we had a huge oil spill in Alaska in 1989 that Exxon caused. And finally, after 14 plus years of litigation, the Supreme Court just ruled basically on behalf of Exxon. You know, Exxon for years has appealed a decision that was made on behalf of the plaintiffs who sued Exxon because their fishing, their commercial fishing, was destroyed. And the Supreme Court just ruled to cut the decision in half. $500 million. It's a drop in the bucket for Exxon.
I think it was like $2 or $3 billion right?
It was. At one point, it was $5 billion, actually.
Yeah, and then it went down, and now it's
with each appeal, it's gone down.
Yeah.
And, you know, so this is, I mean, while this company is making record profits, the largest profits in history, you know, in this country, certainly, you know, these are the people that are going to be benefiting from the oil while everybody is paying, you know, $4.50 plus at the stations to fill up their cars. And so we're not benefiting. The Iraqis aren't benefiting. Who is really benefiting? I mean, Iraq right now, you know, when I was in Damascus, it was, you know, 105 to 110 degrees there. And, of course, if it's that hot there, it's at least 15 to 20 degrees hotter in Baghdad with the orange weather, as they call it, these dust storms that come in and really just leave the place completely orange. I mean, I saw news footage on the weather report, and you really can't see anything. Mm-hmm. And they're living through that with 4 hours of electricity a day, mm-hmm.
if they're lucky. Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that this is Raising Sand on KZSU Stanford, and we're talking with Karen Button, our special correspondent who just returned from Syria. Karen will be sharing some of these interviews. If what Karen says sounds fairly incredible, tune in over the next few weeks, and we'll be running some of these actual audio interviews so you can hear from Iraqis themselves. Many of these interviews are translated,
correct,
right, into English. Many Iraqis actually speak English very well. So we'll be hearing a lot of those, and really looking forward to doing that because, as I say, it is hard to imagine that people are really living in this way, given what was supposed to come of this quick in and out to get rid of Saddam Hussein, who now I believe is looking more and more like a hero in the Middle East than any of us would ever have expected.
Right. Yeah, I think that's really true. I know it's tough listening to all these stories, and it's depressing. It's beyond depressing. I mean, it's beyond a catastrophe there. And it's really difficult to, you know, to continue to listen to these stories, you know, for all of us, because I think all of us feel like, well, what can we do about this? And I think the biggest thing is, you know, these stories are important stories because if it wasn't so important that these stories be told, then I think the Bush administration and the U.S.-led Iraqi administration wouldn't be so keen on trying to make sure that they weren't being heard.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that we can, a big piece of evidence with that is the number of journalists who have been targeted in Iraq. I mean, I can't remember the number at this point, but it's well over 250 who have been killed since 2003
mm-hmm.
inside of Iraq, mm-hmm. trying to just get the truth out, trying to get stories like this out.
Yeah, and a small percentage of those are Americans, so we probably heard more about the Americans, if we have at all, but the fact is that it's a staggering number of people from all around the world, including Iraq.
Mostly Iraqis.
In fact, the Iraqis are, because they're the ones still in the country and are able to move around as much, they're being used a lot more to get news out, aren't they?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, we just don't really hear about the Iraqis, and they're by far, I mean, I don't know the percentage, but I feel comfortable saying that it's at least 60 to 70%.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure at least 70% of the news reporters that have been killed have been Iraqi. And some of these, I mean, it's very clear. I mean, one of the very biggest stories was after the bombing in Samarra, and one of the news reporters.
This is the mosque?
The mosque, yeah. in the Al-Aqsari Mosque in Samarra. And when that happened, there was a news reporter there, a Iraqi news reporter, with her cameraman, and she took footage of it. And, you know, there was a lot of mystery surrounding the aftermath of that bombing. Truckloads of dirt were being taken out and so forth. I mean, there's lots of mystery about, like, who actually bombed there and why. But, you know, one of the things we can say is, why would there be, it's always, where's the motive when something happens? Mm-hmm. You know, who stands to benefit? And this woman was kidnapped along with her cameraman. She was later found beheaded, and her cameraman hasn't been heard of mm-hmm. to this day. Now, what was it that they filmed there you know, that was so damning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what
and
truth?
And of course, the footage has never been found.
The footage has never been found, of course.
Yeah.
You know, but what was so important? What truth was so important there that it couldn't be told?
Karen, I want to be sure that our listeners know that they can get in touch with you. You do speaking engagements, and since you're back here, and you're going to be back for a few months, but you'll be back to Syria at some point.
Yeah, I'll go back this winter.
Yeah, so 6 months or so, you'll be back in the States, and people can get in touch with you at
www.karenbutton.blogspot.com.
And is there a direct email?
Sure. People can reach me at Karen Button, all one word, at riseup.net.
So there you are. Get in touch with Karen, and she can perhaps do a speaking engagement in your community. We just don't know where you'll be at any particular time. So again, Karen Button at riseup.net.
Right.
How can we finish? I would like us to finish on some note that is something that people can do, some way they can get engaged, something, because it is very hard to hear these stories and not be overwhelmed by them, given that this is something that our country is perpetrating.
Right. Yeah, it's a lot to take in. One of the ways that people can help, I think, is there are some good organizations doing some very good work. One of them in Syria is called the Syrian Brotherhood. And I will in the next day or so I'll post they're very, one of the things I like most about this organization actually is that they're very low key. In fact, they've been approached by a number of large corporations who have said, we'd like to give a large amount of money if you will basically advertise for us, and they've said no way. Mm. they have a number of clinics around Damascus and other parts of Syria where they assist people with disabilities. Of course, a lot of Iraqis have disabilities now. They provide medical care. They help with rental assistance and so forth. So I will post that to my blog. Another one that if people want to help here in the States is there is an organization called the Iraqi Student Project. And just full disclosure here, as I'm helping to do some volunteer work with them, actually. And what that organization is doing is it's helping to bring Iraqis to this country, Iraqi student age, university student age, to get a free scholarship or free studies. Mm-hmm. And the way that people can reach that organization is they can go to www.iraqistudentproject.org. At the Nasir Shama concert, it was really pretty amazing to see. I mean, the place was really full, and it would have been nice, of course, to see a lot more Iraqis there. But they were trying it as a fundraiser, so there weren't as many that were able to attend. But I was able to go there with a couple of Iraqi friends, and it was extremely powerful. They were in tears for the majority of it, mm-hmm. And I met with a number of Iraqi friends afterwards who were really deeply moved. This is a man who is so deeply respected around the world. You know, people will say that the Oud was created and then Nasir Shama mm-hmm. was created. And what he did is he spoke of the incredible unity that Iraqis have, this feeling of family that has always been part of Iraq. And then what he did is he played a medley of songs from these different cities around Iraq, and he would call out, this one's from Kirkuk, this one's from Baghdad, this one's from Basra, you know.
Can we hear that?
Yeah, I'll provide you with some music.
We'll go out with that today. So, and then if people want to hear more about him, they can search his name on the internet.
Right, Nasir Shama, it's N-A-S-S-E-R, and then the last name is S-H-A. MMA.
Okay, great. You have mentioned in passing that Iraqis are suffering with their health at this point, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about that.
Actually, I'm really glad you brought that point up. One of the statistics that the UNHCR has documented is that a full 25% of the people that are coming out of Iraq that they've seen have been the victim of torture or violence.
25%.
25%. These are the people that have experienced it, not even the people who have seen it, who have witnessed it. One of the things that the officials there talked about is the extreme need for psychological services. But right now, there's so much focus on just basic services, mm-hmm. just, you know, having homes for people and food on the table, if they have a table. Mm-hmm. So the psychological services is something that they're really hoping that they're going to be able to establish. They have a small clinic now. Where people who are in dire need, let's say if they identify, for example, a woman who's been raped or a man who's been kidnapped and tortured, that they can immediately get them, you know, intervention type psychological services. But this is a huge need that the community has.
And it's something that has to be put off, just as you say, because the very basics have to be attended to first.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Karen, we're really looking forward to hearing some of the interviews that you're going to share with us, and certainly invite you back to talk more about this, because 1 hour is certainly not enough to cover everything that you have learned in this last trip. And we certainly look forward to having you with us again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Thank you.